WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, with Donald Trump as the Republican presidential candidate, is there a new era of liberal patriotism in response? General John Allen heard the chanting at the Democratic convention.
Frankly, I didn't hear the no more war. I'm sure they said it. I'm sure they said it. But what I heard was USA, USA, USA.
It's usually conservatives who chant USA, USA, USA. Does it mean the same thing when Democrats do it? And how about waving the Constitution? That's been a Tea Party thing in recent years. Did Kaiser Khan take the Constitution back for progressives when he waved it at Donald Trump at the Democratic convention? We'll take your calls later in the show. Right now, I'm happy to have John Dickerson with us to begin the program today, the moderator of Face the Nation on CBS and the CBS News political director, also part of the Slate Political Gabfest trio from that weekly podcast with David Plotz and Emily Bazelon, and host of his own podcast called Whistle Stop, which is all little bits of presidential campaign history. And now John has a book of the same name, Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. So we'll talk about the election of 2016 and related in various ways, maybe to the election of 1964 or 1884 or 1824, which might actually have some more frightening parallels than you might want to know about. But we will force you to be informed, even against your will. Hi, John. Congratulations on the book. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to be back, and it's really great to be here in person.
After all our phone dates, here you are, and I'm just dressed like a guy, you know, out there in the summer, and you've got your whole, like, television suit on.
It's true. If I were in a black tie, maybe I could be even more formal.
You're just more respectable than I am. And I'm just going to jump right in on that historical comparison that I mentioned. In that chapter, you write, if there is a constant to the American campaign story, it's that elites can't predict the future very well. It already sounds familiar. In 1824, insiders were certain that Andrew Jackson was not a serious contender for the presidency, right? Unless the contest were to be decided by a fistfight. Ha. So you want to take it from there and expand on why Andrew Jackson was at first dismissed by 19th century elites?
Yeah. Well, so at first, when he gets when his hat is thrown into the ring, they think it's just because he's a stalking horse for John Quincy Adams. This happens a lot. They thought the same thing with Wallace in 1968. Wallace was just put in by the Democrats to steal votes for the Republicans. So there was a lot of coverage at the time. You know, he's not serious. Jackson doesn't really want it. He gave lots of quotes. This was back at a time when the norm was that you didn't actively campaign for the job. You did a lot of things behind the scenes, but you were never supposed to be seen to be seeking the job of the presidency, which led to a lot of confusion, because if somebody said, I really don't want the job, it might very well be a sign that they really did want the job. The idea back then, quaint it seems at the moment, is that you didn't want to actively show that you wanted the job, because then it meant you could be swayed by voters who wanted to put you in the job, and that you would it would be a quid pro quo. If they voted for you expecting a certain kind of behavior, then you would have to keep up that kind of behavior and not make your decisions once you're president.
Wow.
By calm, cool reason.
That's like a different planet of ethics and politics.
It is. And to show that you were virtuous enough for the office was to never show that you wanted the office. So Jackson was taking that posture, and so everybody said, "Oh, well, he doesn't really want the post." And then indeed he did want it, and came very close in 1824.
But also that he was considered too low in some way to be elected president. That's really the parallel I'm thinking.
Oh, yeah. Well, two great parallels, although, I mean, there are so many. So, yes, on one hand, they thought he's just a mere general. I mean, he doesn't know anything about politics. And this, they said this of Eisenhower, too. One of the great complaints about Eisenhower was that he didn't have the temperament for action. This is the guy who, you know, defeated the Nazis or played a major role in doing that. And in the 1952 convention, the Taft forces, Taft, an insider senator from Ohio, his forces said, you know, Eisenhower has no experience. I mean, he's never done anything that has to do with politics. That the and this was what happened in 1824. They thought, A, Jackson knows nothing about politics, and B, much worse, they thought he was a demagogue, that people would think that his heroism in battle – and this is separate and apart from what he'd done to the Indians and so forth and so on, which mm-hmm. is a separate. But at the time, they thought a military general only knows how to fight wars. And that's absolutely not what we want in the presidency. And they worried and wrote and debated about the idea of a demagogue in the office. And a lot of the fear
now
at the time –
it's really getting eerie.
Yeah. A lot of the fear at the time you could just transplant to today. Not – let's say you're a Trump supporter – the fear at the time was that anybody would invest too much power in a single human being, regardless of the human being's qualities. And this is what's a real turning point about Jackson, is that they made the case for Jackson that he was actually a throwback to the colonial era. But in making the case, they said this one man is a throwback, which was a tipping – which tipped a lot of people off. And they thought, wait, the colonial era, the founding fathers didn't ever want so much power and so much of our future to rest in the hands of a single man. Huh.
And he never said, I know how to win. I really know how to win. I win, I win, I win all the time.
No, he didn't say that. But that is what they thought voters would invest in him or project on him, because he'd been a winning general. And in the Battle of New Orleans, and they thought – even the notion that you would have a general who had been so victorious running would tempt people to vote for him based on sort of hero worship and not his fitness for the job.
And as if that wasn't enough, you then tell us Jackson became John Quincy Adams' fiercest challenger, quote, propelled by voters demanding a bigger role in picking their president. And wow, that line got me too, John, because here we are with voters in both parties, the Democrats more so, somewhat in revolt over the role of elites in picking their nominees.
Absolutely. So you have Jackson playing both, if you want to draw the historical parallels, you have Jackson playing both the Trump role, people fearful of investing too much power in a single human being, and then playing the Bernie Sanders role, saying that the Democratic Republicans had this thing they called King Caucus, which was essentially the lawmakers in Washington would choose who the nominee of the party was. There was really only one party at the time. So whoever chose the nominee, whoever the members of Congress in the Democratic Republican Party, which then becomes the Republican Party, excuse me, becomes the Democratic Party after Jackson, would be the ones who essentially picked the president. And that was seen as a horrible thing, to have the president picked by such a small group of elite men. And so the idea was break it open, let the states and at least the conventions in the states play a more vigorous role in picking the nominee.
So really, they were all superdelegates in 1824.
Yeah, super-duper delegates. That's right. And they and also that system was wired in a way so that if you allowed one person to get the presidency, then you sort of waited your turn and you had it the next year. So it wasn't even evaluating the merits of the individual candidates. It was kind of whose turn it was the next time around.
Now, we should say Andrew Jackson lost that race to John Quincy Adams. But you're right that the loss gave birth to a revenge movement led by voters who felt robbed. And again, we have Sanders voters and we have Trump predicting just yesterday to try to change the subject away from Kaiser Khan that the election might be rigged. Again, what was the 1824 version of voters feeling like they were robbed?
So at the end, Henry Clay loses out to John Quincy Adams in the vote. It goes into the House of Representatives. And it's basically between Adams and Jackson. There is a big debate about who won the popular vote. Because some of the votes were done by popular vote, others were done by the state legislature, it's hard to say. The tallies at the time suggested that Jackson had gotten more votes. But if you take a state like Ohio, which went – excuse me, New York, which went for Adams but didn't go in a popular vote. It was done through the legislature. Adams actually had more votes, but nobody at the time they thought Jackson did. Anyway, Clay throws his support behind Adams, which means a number of Western states, most important, Kentucky, from which Clay came from, went to back Adams. And so this was known as the corrupt bargain, because then Adams appoints Clay to be Secretary of State. The idea was, hey, I'll give you my support. The states that are backing me will now go back you. You'll win the presidency. Then you'll name me Secretary of State. There is no evidence there was actually a corrupt bargain, but certainly all the Jackson supporters thought there was one. And so he leaves Washington. He's a senator at the time. Resigns being senator, goes back to Tennessee, and in October 1825, we think our elections start early here, in October of 1825, the same month he resigns, the Tennessee legislature unanimously nominates Jackson to be president in 1828, beginning his revenge march, and then he ultimately, of course, wins in 1828.
And that phrase you just used, the corrupt bargain, is the title of your 1824 chapter in John Dickerson's new book, Whistle Stop. My favorite stories from presidential campaign history. John Dickerson from CBS Face the Nation and the Slate Political Gabfest with us on WNYC. And all right, listeners, John Dickerson is here and he'll take your calls on anything related to this year's campaign, his work in the media. Maybe you're a John Dickerson fan, Gabfest fan, whatever, something from the presidential campaign history that might be of interest to you that you want to ask him about. His book, Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And who thought we'd spend our first 9 minutes of the show today talking about 1824? But overall, when everyone says over and over again this year, you know, this election is unprecedented and there's never been anything like it, do you as a student of history think, well, partly true, but less true than people think?
Well, one of the reasons where these stories come from is in covering our current campaigns, you always get the itch. And for the last six cycles that I've covered, you get the itch to say, is this new? Or if it isn't new, what portions are new? I went back and looked at these stories. And so there are a lot of parallels. In 1968, George Wallace runs a campaign that has a lot of similarities to Donald Trump. Nobody took him seriously at the first. He had a nationalist campaign that appealed to people's worries about the state of the culture and the state of a rising non-white part of America.
Meaning what at that time?
Irish? Well, at times it was blacks, basically, in the African Americans in the cities, both in the South, but in the North in particular. And that was one of the surprises, that Wallace did well, not just in the South, but that he was doing so well in the North that he was a threat to Humphrey. And in fact, what we see right now, Humphrey – so Wallace's pitch to the working man is basically very similar to Donald Trump's. Wallace had a little bit more – fellow feeling with the working man because he was a little closer to that life than Donald Trump's. But nevertheless, the pitch was, he gets it. He knows who I am. He knows what it's like to be on the wrong end of bad policies made by elites. And there was a threat. Humphrey was worried that the Union voters would go to Wallace enough to weaken Humphrey's support in the North, and particularly, sorry, in the Midwest. So the argument that Humphrey made essentially was, hey, this guy Wallace thinks he says he knows what you believe, but if you look at his record in Alabama, wages are lower and he's a union buster in Alabama, so don't believe him. That's essentially exactly what Hillary Clinton is doing now in her bus tour. She said, Donald Trump says he gets you, but don't believe him because of his business practices.
Right.
So you see that parallel. 1964. The Republicans tried to stop Goldwater, which is very similar to the Never Trump movement. And so there are these parallels, even though we look at Donald Trump and we say there's never been a figure like that.
Right. But in 1968, I think most people knew really George Wallace was on the wrong side of history, and his movement, his type of American, was on the decline politically with Trump and with, echoes of George Wallace in the way that so many of us find frightening. This movement is on the rise.
Well, that's one of the things we're going to find out at the end of this election. I think, if you look at the demographics, then you would argue, and a number of Republicans did after the 2012 election, that the number of blue collar workers and the share of white Americans in the electorate is shrinking.
Right.
What's on the rise is the new coalition and the Democratic coalition. But what is what has the marching fervor at the moment is the group that's supporting Trump. But that's breaking up the Republican coalition. We've seen in the polling after the Democratic convention that a lot of those college-educated white voters who used to be in the Republican camp, Republicans have led with those and won that group in every year since 1952 when the polling started. That group is now – Hillary Clinton has a lead with them. So things are breaking apart in the Republican coalition, and the bet Donald Trump is making is he can run up the score with white working class voters and lose some of the previous parts of the Republican coalition that would have voted, say, for Mitt Romney.
Which is exactly why he cares that the debates might be on against NFL games, right?
I think that's right. If his argument is, I want to grow the pie, I want to bring in more voters who haven't voted before but who understand what I'm telling them, people who feel shut out by a system that's constantly betrayed them, then I want those people who are not likely to tune into a debate. That's their definition. I mean, he wants people who are not sitting around thinking about the election because they become so disillusioned by their federal government, by their state governments, just in general, the idea that the system can be fixed. He wants a direct line to them, and if they're all watching the football game, he won't be able to do that.
And not to stereotype football watchers, but those working-class white males who he's appealing to are more likely to be watching the NFL than most other people.
That's his assumption. I mean, that's explicitly his rationale for trying to get the debate switched so that the debates aren't on the same nights as football games.
And, you know, I was wondering if his taunt of the Gold Star parents, Kaiser and Ghazal Khan, might be calculated in that way too. Now, everyone's saying he put his foot in his mouth because he can't control himself, but I'm not sure yet that this is a losing issue for him. And I guess I have a slightly more conspiratorial theory of something that at least might be the case, that maybe it was a dog whistle to exactly those same kinds of voters he's trying to maximize turnout of. Even though the Khan son died a hero, obviously, fighting in the United States Army, and there's risk to going against them in that respect, there they were, dark-skinned, accented, Pakistani-American, she with her head covered. And any time he baits Muslims in any way, his popularity within his target audience has gone up. So rather than a mistake, I wonder if maybe, John, tell me I'm off on planet conspiracy Mars here, but I wonder if maybe it was a get-out-the-vote strategy for his base.
I don't think so. I think his instincts took him to a place that where he is. I think the biggest instinct is his counterpunching instinct, which is both, it seems, consistent with his just temperament, and then also it's been one of the things that his supporters like the most about him, which is he's not going to take any grief from the PC police or the kind of niceties of the elite world. Yeah, and right. When he gets called on it, he doesn't, you know, he stands his ground, and that those qualities in him, his voters like, because they think he's going to behave that way on my behalf now, because right. Nobody in this system has fought like that for me.
And so by that logic, if Kaiser Khan opens his mouth once or twice, then he goes from being Gold Star father to, you know, a guy who's talking back too much to Donald Trump, who doesn't know his place, and then the PC police thing kicks in.
That could be. I think the practical danger of that is, A, all of the families, the service families, know what that is like, what that sacrifice is like, and that is a colorblind, in my experience and as it's been explained to me, a colorblind constituency. And so they are likely to see the service well before any questions of color. Uh-huh. So he's treading in dangerous waters yeah. there. Secondly, he can't – most political analysts would argue, and a lot of Republicans would argue this – he can't win with just that kind of very hardcore group of Trump voters. He's got to expand his coalition a little bit. He's got to not lose traditionally Republican votes. And those white college-educated suburban women voters that he's losing – This is losing them faster in this back and forth.
John Dickerson, host of Face the Nation, with us. His new book, Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. We're talking yesterday and today and how they relate. And I think we've got a good history question for you here from Mike in Freehold. Mike, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. How are you doing? I thought that the reason why we have an electoral college and the reason why we have superdelegates, and I like what John said, super-duper delegates, is because you want to make sure that the layman who really can vote for any silly reason won't put something silly in the office. Like, you can vote as silly as for someone's skin color or for someone's gender, something that makes so little sense when running a country. So we have to have electoral college or superdelegates, people who are more level-headed to make sure we don't put something stupid in the White House.
Well, those are two different things, the electoral college and superdelegates.
Well, yes, although they seek to find the same balance, which is – and this is why the election of 1824 I find so fun, because on the one hand, you have worries about the demagogue. And the way to keep a demagogue from getting in office is things like superdelegates and the electoral college. In other words, to in a republic, to have a mix between those who have between basically the passions of the people and those in government who pay attention to different things. In fact, in the election of 1824, those who are still trying to those who try to defend Clay when he throws his votes essentially to Adams and not to Jackson, they say, look, Clay knows what this job requires. He knows what it means to try to get things done in the federal system, and he knows that Jackson is ill-suited for that. And so thank goodness there's somebody in the process here who isn't just in love with General Jackson and who isn't just swayed by some, you know, beer that they might have given out at a rally, and that's going to save the American system. So and that was all very much a part, and it's still why the superdelegates are argued for, which is that the superdelegates have a long-term interest in the party that's different than the immediate interests of the voters who may participate in the primaries.
Andy in Boonton, you're on WNYC with John Dickerson. Hi, Andy.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. I hope I can – it's a little complicated, so I can say it straight. So you were speaking about Andrew Jackson, and it looks like he was president in 1829, and raised the issue that the specter of returning to kingship kind of haunted those elections of that period. And I hear a lot of people starting to talk about how this election is being haunted by the specter of the rise of fascism in the 1920s and 30s. So what other big specters of the past have hung over American presidential elections, particularly in this early time period? Because I know people are afraid of Vietnam repeating. People are afraid of maybe the rise of nuclear power repeating. But I don't really know much about the specters of the past that haunted late 1800s, early 1900s elections.
Well, the part of what Jackson actually was reacting to in 1824, in the election of 1824 and also in 1828, was the banking system, where particularly in the West, Americans felt like their fortunes – and this will sound quite familiar – Americans had felt their fortunes had been hooked to a banking system that was controlled by and only served the elites. And so that these decisions made in the banking capitals were causing massive undulations in the economy that hurt regular folks, farmers, and working people. Well, that's basically the argument that Bernie Sanders and plenty of others have made in the wake of the mortgage-backed security crash and downturn. And so that the concentration of wealth, it was not a part in so much in – well, it was kind of a part actually of this race as well. I started to think is when you're asking your question about the Gilded Age and the age of the robber barons and the inequities in distribution of wealth in America, that was obviously another thing that is hanging over this election that hasn't really been adjudicated, or it's a part of the conversation certainly, and it's a part of the anger from those people who've seen their wages be flat. But it hasn't broken out in the way where you had during the Gilded Age, where you had people taking up arms and some, in some cases trying to assassinate corporate leaders, because and so we haven't gotten to that stage yet. But the inequities, you could see it heading down that path.
I'm curious to know what it's like to interview Trump as host of Face the Nation. That show, your show, is different from this show. This is a talk show. I can say what I think and then try to be fair to all comers. In that job, you have to play it down the middle much more and not seem to be taking sides. How tricky is that in the case of Trump?
Well, it's tricky in the case of any anybody you interview, because you want to be pressing and pressing to try to get to a result, try to get either for them to give an answer, any answer. That's one thing. The other thing, you want to press and hold them within the bounds of knowable facts, hold them within the bounds of what they previously said, hold them to account for the discrepancies in the things they've previously said. So anytime you're doing that, whether it's with a Republican or a Democrat, you're trying to press. And immediately in our world in which we sort so quickly into teams, whoever's on the opposite side or I should say on the same side of the person you're questioning, will think that your effort to try to get them pinned down is a partisan effort, right, not an effort to try and figure out what it is that they truly believe. What smart politicians know is that it's the fastballs that they get that actually allow them to show themselves in their best light. This was something that Nixon believed, is that the harder the questions, the better you look as a politician. But for a lot of the supporters of that politician, they think, and particularly in the current environment where anybody who asks questions, immediately there's a chorus saying that they're biased. The hard questions or the pressing questions or the questions that point out inconsistencies are seen to come from a place of bias. So that happens with anybody. With Donald Trump, there are more – he is more moving on facts, both in terms of what he's said previously in his campaign to what he's saying now. We see that with the ban on Muslim immigration. I mean, the thrust of the Trump anti-terrorism plan was to stop Muslim immigration in the United States. In conversations I've had with him, he's also worried about the influence of Muslims who are second generation. These are not immigrants. These are people who are born to Muslim immigrants in America. And he has sought, though he hasn't
– because that's who statistically a homegrown terrorist might be.
Right. American citizens, but who have who are Muslims in America. And so that doesn't have anything to do with immigration. It has to do with their religion. And this is something that he's talked about in terms of in conversations I had with him about profiling based on religion. He's talked about the influence when he was just talking about Judge Curiel and how a judge of Mexican heritage couldn't rule fairly on him. He also suggested that would also be true if the judge were a Muslim. So,
well, in fact, I pulled that clip, and I want to play two examples of Trump saying completely outrageous things to you on Face the Nation. I can call them outrageous. You can say what you want. Here is Trump with you on March 6th calling for waterboarding and worse, and you follow up.
The reason that the waterboarding was a number of reasons, but one of them was because the worry was that that if America does that, then our soldiers, American hostages, will be treated even worse. That's the argument. What do you think
of
that?
They're doing that anyway. They're killing our soldiers when they capture them. I mean, they're doing that anyway. Now, if that were the case, in other words, we won't do it and you don't do it, but we're not playing by those rules. They're not, why, did somebody tell ISIS, look, we're going to treat your guys well. Would you please do us a favor and treat our guys well? They don't do that. We're not playing by, we are playing by rules, but they have no rules. It's very hard to win when that's the case.
Is that what separates us from the savages?
No, I don't think so. No, we have to beat the savages.
And therefore throw all rules out.
We have to beat the savages.
By being savages.
No, look, you have to play the game the way they're playing the game.
All right. Oof. Were you getting nervous just hearing that again? Good job. You had to think of coming back at him by saying, by being savages. And then he basically said, yes. And you have to play the game the way they play the game, the way they play the game, ISIS. And I'm thinking Trump calls on the U.S. to be savages in so many words and play like ISIS. And it never broke out as a story quite in that way. But what's an exchange like that to be in the middle of?
Well, so that was the one where you're just trying to follow the logic and the reason down the lane. And my view is that that's exactly what I'm supposed to do. I don't have any I'm just trying to follow him through his thinking. There are people who hear that and think, oh my gosh, that's totally overboard. There are other people who hear that and think, that's exactly right. He is determined to beat this threat in a way that previous presidents have not been resolute enough to follow. And my hope is that in a conversation like that, that takes it down the road as far as you can, that you illuminate whatever his position is so that it allows people to form their own opinions of him. Mm-hmm. One of the things I really hope is that people engage with the thoughts that the candidate is putting forward and the reasoning they're putting forward, and notice when the candidate is falling short or notice when they're making a good point. As a moderator, you're trying to be a window pane for the viewers to look through you at something true about the candidate. Sometimes you can get in the way, and my hope is to not get in the way, but also to illuminate what they actually believe.
So one more example from June 5th, after he had said Judge Curiel couldn't be a fair judge in the Trump University fraud case because the judge is, quote, Mexican, and he, Trump, wants to build a wall. So you followed up.
My question is, if it were a Muslim judge, would you also feel like they wouldn't be able to treat you fairly because of that policy of yours?
It's possible, yes. Yeah, that would be possible, absolutely.
Isn't there sort of a tradition, though, in America that we don't judge people by who their parents were and where they came from?
I'm not talking about tradition. I'm talking about common sense, okay?
I'm talking about common sense. And again, the answer at the exchange is totally outrageous, in my humble opinion. It's common sense to disqualify judges based on their religion. What? So what people call and they say, why is the media treating Donald Trump like a normal candidate? And they're probably thinking that it's time for you and many other people who interview him to cross into Edward R. Murrow, Joe McCarthy territory, where you have to take him down at another level because he's a threat to the Republic, and not treat him like a normal candidate because then too many people will think he's a normal candidate. Do you have that conversation with yourself or your editors?
No. My conversation I have with myself is, what does this person believe and what can I do to illuminate that for people so they can make their own choices, so that they can think for themselves? And if they are outraged by it, then good, be outraged. Go vote. Go do something. If they are encouraged and inspired and motivated by what the candidate says, in this case Donald Trump, then go be motivated. Go exercise your passions out in by getting involved in politics. I think that's where that's what I'm trying to do, and the level of engagement that people should have when they're watching and listening to these kind of conversations.
Let's get in one or two more phone calls for you. John Dickerson with us, host of Face the Nation on CBS on Sunday mornings, participant in the weekly Slate Political Gab Fest, host of his own podcast about presidential campaign history called Whistle Stop, and he has a new book called Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. And Brandon in Greenwich, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me on this morning.
Sure.
Well, I'm enjoying this conversation immensely. I just want to push back slightly against the argument of your guest, which is this notion that when we look at the broader history of the United States, going back to Jacksonian democracy, going back to George Wallace, and then the race, civil rights conflict of the 60s, I do think Trump is without precedent within the modern political realm. It's difficult to find somebody, even when compared to the anti-elitist popular trends that are driving his candidacy, who is so directly threatening to shut down and change our American democracy. For instance, him saying, I will shut down the Washington Post and the New York Times. I will change the libel laws. Aside from a million other controversies with his candidacy, I think we have to be very careful, even in its sober historical reflection that reminds us, you know, we need to have compassion for America's gone through great turmoil in the past. This is a leader I think we need to be very careful about not to diminish the threat of what he represents to our democracy.
So that's a great point. Yeah. No, there is a huge danger in saying, oh, we've all seen this before. There's nothing new here. So you, on the one hand, you also – there's a danger in saying this is all totally new and not seeing the patterns in American history, because I think those patterns allow us to do precisely what you've just done, which is say, sure, there are similarities. We've had businessmen who've gotten their party's nomination before. We've had people who've appealed to voters on the basis of law and order before. But what they haven't done is suggest coercive use of federal power to shut down newspapers. Now, they have, but not in any more recent time. I mean, we did have Lincoln suspended the rights to habeas corpus. So there have been uses of and abuses of federal power before. But I think it is one of the things that I try to do is look at what is similar in the past so that you can illuminate what's quite different in the present. And so the general thrust of your remarks, I think, is exactly right. And I don't want to lapse into thinking like, oh, we've all seen this before, because that's actually the opposite of why I became interested in these stories.
And so just one more, and then we're out of time. In 1976, Gerald Ford, in a debate, didn't know that Poland was under the thumb of Russia. This weekend, Trump didn't know that Ukraine was under the thumb of Russia. In 1976, people cared that Ford was ignorant about that. I'm not sure people care this year if they're drawn to Trump's temperament.
I don't know. It's one of the things we'll see in the end, whether if the Trump vote sticks and there is a ceiling. I mean, part of what's happening in the polling is that there are a lot of people who don't like either candidate, and they're sitting there waiting for inspiration on one side or the other. So the candidates are closer than the individual strength of the candidate, not because one individual candidate is strong. So there may come a time at the end of this election where it looks like Donald Trump has a core group of supporters but was not able to grow it. And the reason he was not able to grow it is because – and now I'm just basically citing what the Trump campaign says – because those voters were not secure in thinking that he could handle the presidency, that he had the temperament for the job. That's what that's the big hurdle the Trump people say he has to clear. And so the answers on Ukraine and the Crimea and Russia, or his seeming unfamiliarity in previous interviews with some of the terrorist groups in the Middle East, or a number of these other issues, the desire to bring back waterboarding, the kind of strongman response to things, that may be what scares off some of those voters that he should have had a chance to go get, because they're traditional Republican voters. So in the end, we'll have to see exactly kind of whether that does have a bigger impact, or whether, as you say, people really don't care because they think something bigger is at stake. And the thing they think is bigger is at stake is something they think Donald Trump can address, and this other stuff is all just kind of small.
John Dickerson, the moderator of Face the Nation on CBS, and he's the CBS News political director, also part of the Slate Political Gabfest trio from that weekly podcast with David Plotz and Emily Bazelon, and host of his own podcast called Whistle Stop, which is bits of presidential campaign history, and his brand new book is called Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. Always great to talk to you. I always learn from you. Let's keep doing it.
Thanks so much, Brian. I really enjoy it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.